Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And you know what? It's always fun to talk science with our next guest, Bassam Shakashiri. Back with us once again. He's been doing this for a long, long time. Professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison and a master of chemical demonstrations. And we're going to get one or two of those today on the show. We're going to be videoing the experiments, and we're going to be posting them up on our Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think about that? Along with that, we'll be talking about some of the challenges science faces today in our society. He has this science experiment I talked about. And of course, he always loves to answer your science questions, be it about science and education or maybe science and politics, whatever. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us again. After, this is 48 years you've been a teacher here, a professor here at UW, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, no, you're not mistaken. I'm always happy to be with you, Larry. This is a fantastic opportunity for me and for the listening audience. Of course, we talk about science, but doing science is more important. And so that's why we have an experiment that we have put together here, my friends and I, my two collaborators in the Science is Fun program. So in the summertime, you go on picnics and you have drinks that you want to cool, and you put them in a bucket full of ice and water. And sometimes if you pay attention, as all of us should pay attention, you notice that, some of the cans are floating and others are sinking. So the experiment we have here is, you describe it for us.
We've got a beaker, and inside the beaker, it's filled with water, and inside the water, we have a Diet Coke, if I'm not mistaken, a can of Diet Coke, and a can of regular Coke, and the can of Diet Coke is floating, and the regular can is not.
And why do you suppose that is, Larry? What are the differences between the diet drink and the sugar drink?
Well, obviously, one has sugar, and the other has something like an aspartame-type product that is sweet, but doesn't is not sugar.
It's not sugar, but the amount that is used in the sweeteners is so small compared to the 39 grams, almost 40 grams of sugar that is in a regular drink. And so in this experiment that everyone has encountered, when you go on a picnic, you see this. It's a difference in density. It's a difference the amount of sweetener that is present there. So we have this experiment on our website. We have lots of experiments on my website. Another one that we have is with this bottle. Is there a bottle with some beads in it?
What color are the beads? I've got some red beads and some yellow beads, and I'm kind of shaking it up right now.
All right, and let's put it down and see what happens. Let's put it down, and now you see, where are the yellow beads now?
Well, the yellow beads are on the top, and the red beads sunk right to the bottom.
And the yellow beads are doing what? Are they just
Now they're starting to slowly sink, and the red beads are starting to slowly come up. And
they might
join.
Even like each other. Who knows, right?
Well, they're joining.
Yes, yes. And
isn't
so this
cool?
is another experiment that relates to differences in density. It is on our website, scifun.org, scifun.org. We invite you and everyone in the listening audience to download these experiments and try them at home. Do them with the family. Do them with your friends. There are instructions on how to do all of these experiments. Everything is very well tested. They're all safe to do. And we want to wish everyone a happy, happy summer and a joyful series of picnics, events, and celebrations.
Well, it's really a lot of fun to do these. And one of the things about it is if you've got some children, actually young or old could enjoy this, but I think as a way to get youngsters interested perhaps in science and why those things do what they do, I think it's a good thing for a parent or a grandparent to get involved with.
It's good for all of us. We're all curious. We always ask questions. Kids are usually less inhibited about asking questions than adults. Actually, during my visits through retirement homes, I notice every time I go there that the retired people are also less inhibited about asking questions. And so we all ask questions. We are all curious. We wonder about the beautiful world that we live in. And that's why we want to be fully engaged with nature. We want to be fully engaged with each other, so that we get to enjoy the beautiful world that we all live in.
You've been involved in bringing science to the public for probably the whole 48 years you've been here, and maybe before that even. And why is it so important to you?
Science is another way of looking at the world. It's actually an outstanding way to understand the world that we live in. And science is a discipline. Science involves asking questions, trying to find explanations, answers to those questions, trying to make sense of the observations that we make. We receive sensory information through our eyes, ears, skin, taste, and smell. And it's amazing how the brain constructs all of that, puts all that information together and constructs images and constructs knowledge. So learning science is important. Appreciating science is important. Not everyone wants to be a scientist. That's fine. But appreciating science is exceedingly important. We live in the most advanced scientific and technological world in history. All the benefits that we enjoy now in transportation, healthcare, communication, you name it, everything, yeah, is the result of science and its twin technology. And that's why it's important to be literate in science, to have a sense of appreciation of what science is, what science can do, what the limitations of science are. Science is not the answer to all the questions that we as human beings have. But science enriches us. Science makes us fully appreciative of the world that we live in.
You know, I'm a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication, and one of the things we do in that department is to teach students how to communicate science to publics. And I sometimes think that the scientists can be their own worst enemy when it comes to this area. Sometimes I feel like the information communicated to the public or to others is just, they overcomplicate things.
Well, to be successful in science, you have to be sharply focused.
Yeah.
Actually, to be successful in anything, you have to be sharply focused and you have to be excelling in what you do. Now, developing skills for communication, that's a different story altogether. And that's what your department, and that's what I and my group actually focus on a great deal.
Yeah.
To develop the skills of effective communication of science. It's not just sharing the facts. It's not only sharing the beautiful color transformations or differences in density as we did a little earlier. It is developing an attitude that nurtures curiosity. We're all curious, and so we need to nurture that curiosity, and science helps us do that. Science and technology, Larry, are the engines that drive our economy. So we have to, as a society, develop a better sense of appreciation of what science and technology are, what they can do for us, and also to learn, as we develop this sense of appreciation, to learn about all the consequences of advances in science and technology, not only the good ones, but also the not-so-good ones.
Yeah.
So this is a very important responsibility that those of us who care about science communication should be dealing with. It's not simply telling you what's going on in my lab. It is much more than that.
Yeah.
It is helping develop a healthy attitude toward learning, toward science, toward life.
You know, we have a couple of callers online. I can't even remember if I gave the phone number, but I will do it right now. Here's the number to call. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. A question about science or a comment I hope you'll join in. You can email us as well at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Vern in Stanley, Wisconsin's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Vern, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Oh, good morning. I took chemistry. I was 99%. I don't want to brag in science. You know, all grade 12 and on. But here's the thing. We convert kilograms to pounds and pounds to kilograms and an ounce. You know, there's so many ounces, so many grams in a pound, whatever.
Yeah.
But pound is the unit of force, and kilogram is the unit of mass. They are not convertible. Poundo is the unit, and newton is the unit that has to be used.
And are you right, Vern? There are technical ways to define mass and to define weight, and we should be aware of that. However, it's important to be able to do the conversion between those two types of units. In science, we use the metric system, not the British system. Actually, the United States is one of the very few countries in the world that uses the British system for measurements. And many, many people, many of our congressional leaders have tried for decades to change our use from the British system to the metric system, miles, to kilometers, and so on, without much success. I am puzzled by that, but we live with it. And as long as we can do the conversions, we should be okay. And everyone should be able to make those conversions, degrees Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius. But you're right. We have to be aware of the proper definitions of what the units are.
Yeah. I was thinking about I'll be in Canada next week for an event, and they use the metric system there, but they still talk about themselves as being 5'10" or 5'11" or whatever. That it hasn't all completely disappeared.
Well, hand me that 2x4 that you have over there, Larry.
There you go. Vern, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Larson, I think, is up next. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Morning, Larry. Morning, Bassam. Morning. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, or at least partially, about scientists being their worst enemies in communication. We have a bigger problem than, a more fundamental problem, and that is people believe what they want to believe, regardless of what science says. Climate change is just a great example of that, where the overwhelming majority of scientists have established that climate change is caused by largely by human interactions. Yet we have a presidential administration that essentially believes that this is a hoax. So what we're trying to do is I'm a member of an organization called Wisconsin's Green Fire, and this very issue is a topic for our summit that starts tomorrow and runs through Thursday, that we need to figure out how we communicate to the people who perhaps are in the middle, who don't have an opinion one way or the other. How do we make sure that they see us as reliable, valid sources of information?
Thank you, Jim, for your observation. I think what Larry meant when he said that scientists are their own worst enemy, he was just trying to be provocative to get scientists to improve the way by which we communicate not only with each other, but especially with people who are non-scientists. It's a matter of being respectful whenever you have a conversation with someone about any topic. But let's talk about climate change. Yes, there are people who do not believe that climate change is real, and they can say whatever they want to say about it. Jim, we live in a free country. Everyone can express themselves any way they wish to. However, with that freedom comes responsibility. And that responsibility for us in science, for us also for people who are not scientists, is to become aware of what we know in science about climate change. Global warming is unequivocal. This is not a subject to debate. We don't debate what the odds of winning the lottery are. We can debate and vote on whether or not we want to have a lottery. So scientific facts are not debatable. What is debatable is how we interact with each other successfully and respectfully. I want to come back to this point and really, really push hard on it. the purpose of any conversation you and I have with someone else about climate change is to have another conversation. It is very important to be confident. It's very important to be respectful. And it's very important to be trustworthy. The purpose of the conversation, as you say, can deal with matters and beliefs that people have. And we have to be respectful of each other as fellow human beings. I'm not saying we respect what anyone says necessarily, but we have to be very, very careful about effective communication so we can influence attitudes. We can influence not only our own attitudes, but the attitudes of other people in society. Because whether or not people believe in climate change is immaterial. Climate change, global warming are unequivocal, and we have to develop ways to mitigate, to successfully deal with these issues. So my plea to you and everyone in the listening audience is to be respectful and to engage in conversations that hopefully will be productive.
Thanks very much for calling, Jim. Appreciate your call. Brad in Milwaukee will give you a chance now. Brad, hi. Thank you for calling.
Can you hear me? I got a bad connection, but hopefully you can hear me. And here's what I think is missing in part of this. A lot of the climate change deniers, and my mom is one of them, happen to be fundamentalist Christians. And one of the things I think science misses is this. These fundamentalist Christians have a belief that God is somehow going to rescue us from this climate change. My mom's articulated this. And I said, God is not coming to step in. God gives you a choice. He put us on this planet. And I'm not going to get into a whole thing about the existence of God here, but the thing is this. God is not going to step in when you talk about responsibility, as you did to the last caller. And part of responsibility is people, the believers, the fundamentalist Christians, understanding that God is not going to step in and right our wrongs.
Thank you, Brad, for your observations and for your comments. let me just say, today, the two strongest forces in society are science and religion. It's not just today. It's throughout the ages. And it's very important for us to recognize and to accept that they are very strong forces, and we should be careful and respectful when we engage in conversations about both of them. So it's not a matter of trying to get a climate change denier to admit that they are wrong. It's a matter of talking about the consequences of inaction when it comes to matters that relate to the climate, when it comes to matters that relate to our daily lives. Climate change has a lot of effects. My suggestion, Brad, and to you and everyone else in the listening audience, is to talk about the quality of life that we have in our communities, to talk about the richness of the greenery that we see around, to talk about water and how important it is not only for human consumption but for agriculture, to talk about controlling us human beings, controlling pollution. It's very, very important that we do that. If we start the conversation by saying that, as I have said already, that climate change is unequivocal, global, then that immediately puts up a wall between me and the person that I want to talk to. So my advice is not to start with that, not even to get around to it. Talk about the effect of these horrendous changes, some catastrophic changes that will occur if we don't mitigate and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. Fossil fuels, as a result of the Industrial Revolution, have tremendously improved the quality of life on the planet. As I said earlier, anything that you can think of that relates to the great quality of life we have on the planet is the result of science and technology. But with those advances, there were other things that we did not know about. It's true that about 100 years ago, someone, a scientist by the name of Arrhenius, predicted. There was another woman, actually, who also predicted that carbon dioxide will have a warming effect on the planet. But those predictions were not heeded. And we need to develop new technologies, as we are doing. This is one of the great things about the United States and about the world in general.
We are glad to have with us today Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of science today with our guest, Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Pleased to have you listening in today. Join in our conversation as we talk science with him. Comments or questions at 800-642-1234. Give a call. You email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. You know, just we had an email I wanted to get in here from Louise. She is already wondering when tickets for the December science program will be available, and she's missed it the last couple of years and wants to make sure she doesn't miss it again. And you might explain what that is before we go back.
Thank you, Louise, for your inquiry about Once Upon a Christmas Cheery in the Lab of Shakashiri, which is an annual program we've been doing for 48 years, number 49 coming up in early December. And this is a celebration of the joy of science. It's a program for kids of all ages. And it is videotaped, recorded by Wisconsin Public Television, uplinked to PBS stations around the country and elsewhere. So tickets, the free tickets, will be available sometime around October 1st. So
okay.
Look at our website and look for announcements there as to when you can make a request for a free ticket.
And you take your Science is Fun show on the road a bit around the state, do you not? Or if not you, then some of the people you work with.
Larry, as we speak, two people from our group are in Horicon, Wisconsin. As we speak, Dr. Gary Essenmacher and Kyle Acevedo are in Horicon. They did a program at 10 o'clock this morning. They're doing another one this afternoon. We've been to many parts of the state. We have been to Viola. We were at Kickapoo schools just last Friday. We go to farmers markets. Everyone in the listening audience is invited to look at my website under events of interest, where we list where we're going to be. We have been very fortunate to, from a donor, to get a van. Actually, it's a truck which is equipped with
pretty
chemicals.
Cool truck.
It is a cool truck. It's equipped with chemicals and equipment. And we go to different locations. We are happy to accept requests. We get way too many requests to go to different places. This is our way of living the Wisconsin idea. The Wisconsin idea for the 21st century aims to foster community appreciation of science. We want to cultivate creativity. We want to connect with people, with kids of all ages. We want to go to schools, community events. As I said, we're doing farmers market. Dane County Parks is having a huge celebration on June 2nd. An all-day celebration near Lake Wabisa. It's all on the web. Just find out how to get there. We invite everyone to participate. And if you are away from Madison, just email us at the bottom of the scifun.org page, scifun.org. You can send us an email requesting information about visiting your community and how we can try very hard to make that happen.
Let's take some more calls. Adam in Chippewa Falls has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Adam, hi. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so I've been listening to the program. I appreciate it. You guys are doing a great job. My question, or rather comment, was something said earlier about how, while there's no debating science facts, like a fact is a fact, you can't debate that. But I think inherently science, and I, you know, there's plenty of things that science has proven, but inherently the science depends on the quality of the questions, like the hypothesis that's been asked. And if you have poor hypothesis, well then, or you're, you know, single-minded, you're only asking one question, you can prove a lot of things, you know, and there's plenty of examples of that where science has thought one thing and then years later been said, oh, well, actually that science that we did that we thought was factual is now incorrect. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case with, you know, global warming, but obviously there's still some debate between some scientists with that. And so I think until systemic review and the test of time has been done, you can't make an all-knowing factual statement about that science is fact and there's no debating science.
Thank you. In science, we make progress by being skeptical. We're always questioning. We always question the facts. We affirm the facts if that turns out to be the case. We're open-minded about it. There is no dogma per se. It is free, responsible inquiry. That's what scientists do. Excuse me. You're right. In many cases, hypotheses are formulated, and how you ask the question is really, really important. One of the things that we try to teach at the undergraduate level, and especially at the graduate level, is how to formulate the question so that you have a fighting chance of getting some successful answers to it. So scientific inquiry is open, it is free, and you're right, interpretations change over time. They could change over time. So Adam, are you still on, Adam?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Adam, did the sun rise this morning?
It did.
Are you sure?
I actually saw it, yes.
Does the sun actually rise, Adam?
No, I suppose that depends. I was just going to say that depends on how you're defining rise. The Earth turned. At least from my perspective, it did.
Yeah.
It is a very good way for all of us to communicate with each other about sunrise, sunset, and so on. But you and I know that the sun doesn't rise, right?
Yeah.
So we have to decide how to find successful ways to communicate with each other. So that's my response to your question. I appreciate the fact that you're thinking about this.
Yeah.
As I said, I appreciate the fact that you're thinking about it.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Adam. Appreciate it. Well, we had one Adam. Let's get another Adam on from Glendale this time. Hi, Adam. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Good morning. Don't mean to turn the show into a global warming perspective. Wanted to share a study that I did actually last weekend. I'm intrigued by the volume of air that vehicles consume. And so I did some math and figured out that a 3-liter common average car will consume or use or process an amount of air equal to half of a full-size garage. And that kind of stunned me. And so I did some further research about the amount of vehicles in the world and cargo ships and semi trucks. And what I found was that on a daily basis, the average car used for a half an hour a day, if everybody in the world used their car a half hour a day, that is 1.5 cubic miles of air that's consumed in a day. Cargo ships turned out to be 110 cubic miles per day that are processed through the engines of cargo ships. And then if you add up all the semis, it's in the range of 55 cubic miles per day. And I'm sure there's some flaws to my study, but it's a tremendous amount of air that's being processed and filled with carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide on a daily basis. And I wanted to plant that seed and see your perspective.
I'm glad to hear that you're engaged in doing some calculations and thinking about different aspects of the combustion process. Air is mostly nitrogen, and it's, you know, about 20% almost. I'm just rounding off here, 20% oxygen, and that's what's used in the that's what the combustion process is all about. And so, as I say, I'm glad that you're doing these calculations. I have not seen them. I heard what you said about them. And, you know, in science, we like to scrutinize and examine carefully what others have said and have come up with. And so, you know, this is how we try to verify calculations and see if they are accurate, if they make sense. I'm not saying yours don't make sense or don't are not accurate. I'm just saying they have not been subjected to others looking at them.
To review.
Yeah. So thank you, Adam, for being engaged. I really appreciate it. And I wonder, before you go, Adam, why did you do this calculation?
Well, I'm an inventor, and I watch a lot of public TV shows, and I watch a show about a gentleman back in the 1850s that did some experiments with carbon dioxide in a chamber, and the study of the amount of heat increase that carbon dioxide has been proven to affect the air. And that was kind of the purpose of my call, was because I want to plant the seed. There needs to be a conversation about, you know, vehicles consuming the volume of air that they do.
I would thank you for sharing that. I hope you're willing to share your calculations with others in your immediate community, just maybe a science teacher or an engineer or anyone interested in the topic. Just sharing, I think, is very, very important. So please consider doing that.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, here we had commencement at the UW-Madison last week. I happened to be in Bayfield, so I wasn't able to attend this year. I know you give a lot of commencement addresses. What's the advice you usually give college, or you do some high school commencements?
I've done high schools, universities. I've done colleges, in the country and overseas, and you know that. The end of the academic year is always a very exciting time.
Yeah.
And I have mixed feelings about it because the students who graduate, I'm not likely to see them again. But they're off to doing what they have chosen to do. Hopefully they have jobs. So commencement, you know, is a time for commencing with your future. And advice that I think about giving, you know, nowadays, if I were giving a commencement talk, is to reflect on the experiences that you've had, see how these experiences have made you a better person, and decide what good you're going to do in the world. Decide for yourself about the goodness that you would like to contribute to the world. That would be my general theme, Larry.
Well, that's a good theme. I like that theme. Oh, man, you may have noticed, by the way, that we are in an election year. It would be hard not to notice that. How is science involved in the elections?
Well, all scientists and everyone who is eligible to vote should vote. That's something we should really take to heart and act on it. And so my plea to everyone in the listening audience is, of course, vote, but try to get 5 to 10 other people to vote also. We have primaries coming up later in the summer in Wisconsin, and also in your listening area outside of Wisconsin. And we have the November election. All the issues we've been talking about that relate to quality of water, to the economy and the effect of science and technology on the economy require us to support candidates and to elect people at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, who are capable and willing to make intelligent choices for the very difficult issues that we face. I think it's a big responsibility for us to understand the role of science and technology in society. We've got very, very grand challenges that face us, not only in this country, but around the world. We mentioned climate change being one. Water is another one. Larry, around the world, as we speak now, there are 1.3 billion people who cannot do what I am about to do, namely take a drink of water.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And they're not all outside the United States. So these are issues that affect the quality of life. These are questions that are scientific in nature as far as the solutions are concerned. But as far as the attitudes that people have, that's what we should be working on. I am a strong advocate of scientists behaving as scientist citizens. Take responsibility for sharing effectively science and helping develop attitudes that are healthy towards science, including being skeptical. As I said earlier, this is how we make progress in science, by being skeptical. I am also a strong advocate of achieving science literacy. Science literacy is an attitude. It's like personal hygiene. It's something that we have to develop so that we are fulfilling the social contract that we have between science and society. The social contract that scientists have with society is at the heart of what should be discussed in an election year, actually should be discussed every year. The social contract enables scientists to achieve great intellectual results, but it also comes with mutual expectations of benefiting the human condition, and that's something that we should be really, really talking about as scientists and as responsible citizens. So I would say that being effective in sharing, in communicating, in listening, all conversations should lead to more conversations, respectful conversation. It doesn't mean that you don't, you know, once in a while get hot under the collar and so on, but stay civil, stay respectful, act in a manner that you'd like others to act with you. And so that's, I'm really wishing and looking forward to respectful discourse between now and November 6th. And I not only wish it, but I'm going to work very hard to make it happen. And by the way, the 5 to 10 other people that I'm going to try to talk to about voting are not people that I already know are going to vote. Those are people that may not have thought about voting or may be disinterested in voting, and engage in a conversation about the importance of everyone participating in the democratic institutions that we belong to and that we cherish so deeply.
And on that note, Bassam, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison. He's got, as always, he's got his Science is Fun T-shirt on. I heartily encourage you to go to his website, scifun.org, because there are tons of great science experiments that you can do right at home that aren't going to blow the place up, but they're a lot of fun to do.
We're not going to blow anything up. We're going to blow your mind.
There you go. Thanks, Bassam. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest. And, of course, he comes by every so often to talk with us, and he'll be back, and we will talk with him once again. You know, there's some science involved in baking. And we're going to be talking about with some folks who are very good at baking, and they've been involved in even some lawsuits relating to it.
relating to the sale of home-baked goods. Lisa Kivrist, one of our guests today, the other, her husband, John Ivanko. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network.